Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast.
Hi, everyone. I am joined today by Dr. Alan McKay. Dr. Alan teaches criminal law at the University of Sydney. He's a member of the management committee of the Julius Stone Institute of Jurisprudence, also at the University of Sydney Law School, and at Macquarie University is an affiliate member of the Center for Agency Values and Ethics. He has previously taught at the Law School at the University of New South Wales and the Business School at the University of Sydney. Alan trained as a solicitor in Scotland and has also practiced in Hong Kong with the global law firm Baker McKenzie. His first book, Free Will and the Law, New Perspectives, is published by Routledge. His second book, with Nicole Vincent and Thomas Nederhoff, is entitled Neural Interventions and the Law, Regulating Human Mental Capacity, and is published by Oxford University Press. He holds a PhD from the University of Sydney Law School and is interested in behavior genetics, neuroscience, neurotechnology, and the criminal law. His philosophical interests relate to free will and punishment, and ethical issues emerging from artificial intelligence. In relation to legal practice, he is interested in behavior legal ethics and the future of legal work. He has also published extensively in various journals, and his work has appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The Australian, and Radio National, and overseas global media sources, including The Independent, The Statesman, The Huffington Post, and The Conversation. Dr. Alan, it's very great to have you here today.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Right, so we know there has been a recent announcement by Elon Musk on his company Neuralink. And I think perhaps a focus of our conversation today is going to be relating to this, given your extensively experience publishing around these issues. What was your first thoughts in relation to the technology that he announced last week?
I come to it from a very, maybe a little bit different perspective, because my first thoughts I was interested to hear what kind of uses the technology might be put to with a view to considering some of the legal and ethical issues. And I was just interested to hear their progress. And one thing I did think was I probably would have liked to have heard a bit more about some of the legal and ethical issues that relate to the technology, and that didn't seem to appear in the big announcement. And I thought that maybe that would have been a good thing to include.
Yeah. So what are the, you obviously have done a lot of research on these issues. What are the main concern there? We know that the technology has a lot of potential for good in terms of improving health of people suffering from brain damage and other issues. What are the main concerns there?
So, I think you're right to emphasize the potential for good. One of the aims of the technology is to restore capacity perhaps to people with spinal injury. And, you know, we shouldn't stop that. That's very important, and that's a massive benefit. And, you know, if the technology can help people who can't move around to move around again, if it can restore ability to communicate, that's wonderful, and shouldn't stop that. But at the same time, you know, I think there's sort of issues relating to how the data is handled, the brain data, privacy of the relating to the brain data, and there's issues about autonomy and sort of free will. You know, like if ultimately, you know, maybe talking more generally about neurotechnologies, if they do sort of engage in things like brain stimulation, you know, whether people are still fully autonomous and maybe subject to some kind of manipulation, which is a concern. There's issues relating to, you know, personal identity, I think, that are not, you know, perhaps not, I'm talking generally about neurotechnology now, that, you know, if you know, some people feel a bit strange from themselves if their brains are stimulated. But you know, it seems like the immediate the immediate aim for Neuralink seem to be focusing on using the brain the implanted brain computer interface to control devices. And you know, maybe some of those issues are not raised by that, but you know, there are some interesting questions for things like the criminal law, you know, which is set up for presumably if people start to interact with the world by way of brain computer interface, presumably at some stage, if not already, they'll start to commit offences. And there's some interesting questions from my own area one of my own areas of research. And then, of course, I mean, I guess another issue might relate to employment. You know, like if you can imagine a class of people who are enhanced through neurotechnologies, including Neuralinks, perhaps others, then and another unenhanced class. You know, there's a concern about a division in society with upgraded people and people who are not upgraded, and that may lead to pressure to enhance by way of neurotechnology. And that's you know, if that pressure, say, came from an employer, there's some issues for employment law. Yeah, there's a lot to consider. As I say, I don't want to, you know, like, it sounds like I'm sort of harping on about the downside, and there are some possible problems, and they do need to be considered, but you know, I want to emphasize that I think there's really some enormous benefits, particularly for possible benefits for people, particularly for people with some form of disability. And wow, that those should go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel, you know, the goal of these conversations is not to discourage such innovations. You know, we need them to essentially work in our favor and making our lives better, you know, improving health and the quality of our lives, really. This technology particularly, I think a lot of people were in a way excited. It's something quite new, because it's a strong step towards merging humans and artificial intelligence, right?
Yeah, and that does seem to be a sort of a thing that Elon Musk is interested in, and I think he thinks that that might, you know, there's, of course, there's a great, you know, there's concerns about the future of humans, perhaps in the workplace, if AI starts to outperform humans. I'm not saying it will, but if that were to be the case, and, you know, I guess Elon Musk thinks that this is might be a way for humans to keep up with the competition. But the, I mean, an issue is how available is the technology, because it might only be some humans who keep up with it. I think he was hoping that at some point it might, you know, the cost might be sort of somewhat affordable. But yeah, one of the social issues to wrestle with is the issue of a divided population with some enhanced and some unenhanced.
Yeah, increase of inequality, right?
Yeah, that would be it. And so, you know, some humans with far greater capacity than others, and that's something that's raised generally by all sorts of neurotechnologies. I mean, I think one thing, you know, there's a couple of things really, you know, so one thing is that I think it's a good thing for neurotech companies to have some kind of ethical input, you know, that's kind of integrated into the development, not just develop the thing and then kind of say, okay, well, what are the problems with this thing we've developed? I'm not saying that may be the case with Neuralink. I don't know. I didn't hear them talking about that in great detail, so I don't know. But then I think another thing goes to the, you know, to the regulation of this technology and the thinking about the legal implications. And, you know, I think maybe law reform bodies, for example, might need to start to address such issues you know, with greater haste than they've done up to now. And also people in, you know, scholars, academics, there's many, well, there's quite a few, I shouldn't say there's many, there's quite a few philosophers who have considered the ethics of neurotechnology. So in my, you know, we've got a great chapters in my new book with Nicole Vincent and Thomas Nadelhofer, Neurointerventions, the Law Regulating Human Mental Capacity. And so Walter Glannon and Frederick Gilbert and Susan Dodds have contributed chapters. And there's Marcello Ienka, you know, in other parts of the world that are doing other stuff. I think though that you know, I think that lawyers need to pay a bit more attention to it. There's not enough work being done by academic lawyers in neurotechnology. There's lots of them working in AI, but not neurotechnology.
Yeah.
So I think there's not enough thinking about it yet.
Yeah,
maybe Elon Musk's announcement will stimulate some.
Yeah, it's definitely time, isn't it, that these conversations start to unfold. But I feel brain implants are not necessarily new, right? Might be new the way you know, Neuralink is proposing, which is perhaps more invasive. But we already have technologies available for, you know, enhancing brain capacity in a way, for example. So, you know, there is one specific technology that I guess I can mention here. It's called Halo, and it's essentially, you know, a pair of headphones that people in the sports industry can wear, and it basically helps them to perform better than, you know, perhaps the person next to them. So,
yeah.
You know, what's the difference here? Is that because, you know, Neuralink technology is more invasive? Do we have more risks, do you think?
Yes. So the, there's, if you think about neurotechnology, you're right to point out, yeah, there's non-invasive and invasive neurotechnology. And in the non-invasive neurotechnology, there's various consumer neurotech companies that are, that are producing various devices that don't involve implantation to read or even try and stimulate neural activity. I mean, I think there's a couple of issues there. I mean, like, one of the issues is the issue of regulation. So Elon Musk's Neuralink has got to, because it's implanted, it's got to go through the Food and Drug Administration regulatory regime. And then there's this question about, well, what about these non-invasive devices that are not so obviously medical, particularly if they're just reading, and where's the regulatory regime for that? Some companies have opted for an invasive route. Some have opted for a non-invasive route. I mean, I think the aim of the invasive route is the signal is better. It's easier to read signal, once something has come through a human skull, the signal's not so good. And so a disadvantage for a company that's engaging in neurotech of an invasive route is there's a more rigorous regulatory regime, a disadvantage for those that pursue, I think another company, Kernel, are pursuing a non-invasive route, is that it's, thus far, it seems trickier, the technology's trickier. The signal is not so good. So that's my understanding. I should say I'm from a law and somewhat ethics background. So, but my understanding is the reason why Neuralink may have opted for invasive devices to get better and more precise data and options for stimulation.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a few different implications. So we have criminal law, which we could say it's perhaps your expertise, as you have done a lot of work in this area. We have implications for employment, future of work, privacy, and free will. So perhaps let's try to discuss these implications separately. So starting with criminal law, which I think it's a very much a big foundation there. Can you give us a little bit more details or example of scenarios that, we might have to think about when dealing with such technology?
Okay, so one issue is, in this is something I've written about, so I'll start with that. So in criminal law, there's an idea of they call it the fault element or the guilty mind. It's called mens rea. So intention to kill, for example, is one of the mens rea for murder. But another aspect to the way the law sees conduct is the criminal act, the actus reus. So, if you punch someone, or say you stab someone in the chest at a time when you intend to kill them and they die, then unless you've got some kind of defense, it sounds like you've perform the actus reus for murder, an act causing death, and you had the mens rea for murder at the time. You intended to cause their death. But then if people start to interact with the world by way of brain-computer interface, well, there's a question. Well, let's say, you know, so the in America, they've got these, my understanding is some of the universities have got brain drone races. And what they do is they control a drone with a non-invasive brain-computer interface, generally. And so they have these mental acts, like they might imagine hand waves or something like that, and then the drone flies around under their control. If somebody were to kill somebody, fly a drone into someone intending to kill them, well, they've got the mens rea for murder. But what was the criminal act? Was it imagining a hand wave? You know, maybe the hand wave is the signal that flies the drone into the person. That's unusual. Like usually a criminal act, the conduct constituting the actus reus can sometimes be an omission, but it's usually a criminal act. It's usually a bodily act, like typing something, punching someone, saying something. There's this kind of distinction between the mental and the physical, the external element, which is somewhat strange in the context of brain computer interfacing. So that's one sort of theoretical question. And it's sort of, you know, the law might say, okay, well, the criminal act was the mental act. And that's a big step, you know, like a thought, that's the criminal act, because it controls things outside in the world. Or they might say, well, the neural activity associated with the mental act, that was the criminal act. So you kind of jiggled your motor cortex. That seems strange. Or if it was an implanted BCI, you might say, well, okay, the defendant is a cyborg and they're part organic, part inorganic, and they flowed signal through the inorganic part of their body because it's a cyborg body. The law might go for some combination of them, but the point is that they're all a bit strange and it requires a bit of rethink of a concept that's central. So this is something that criminal law students learn in week
never
two.
Never thought about.
Yeah, but it's right a bit. So I can remember internet technology coming in, and of course there had to be a rethink of the criminal law. They had to create all these new offences like hacking and that sort of thing. But it was kind of chapter 11 of the book, not chapter 1 or chapter 2. You know, it was a bit more, it seems like the newer texts more core. Then another sort of interesting thing is Frederick Gilbert and Susan Dodds in our new book, they have considered the situation where so there's some neurotechnology that's addressed at helping epileptic people. And so basically what can happen is people can have some sort of brain implant that detects the neural activity associated with an impending epileptic fit, seizure, and then it alerts them to it. And that's a great thing, you know, like this is a, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And then it can maybe advise them. So maybe send them an SMS, for example, the tech links up to their phone and send them an SMS. And so they can take some medication or move themselves out of a place where they might fall down or something. But Frederick Gilbert and Susan Dodds, they've considered the situation where instead of detecting the neural activity associated with an epileptic fit, the some sort of brain technology, some sort of brain implant. It detects the neural activity associated with an angry outburst. And, you know, it just, through machine learning approaches, it starts to learn the precursors to an angry outburst, let's say in me. And it's, instead of looking for seizures, it looks for outbursts, and it sends a message to me. It says, Alan, you're about to lose your temper, like Begbie in the train spotting film. And so, you know, hopefully I've got some more information now. And then if I'm minded, if I don't want to, you know, lose my temper and lash out and commit an offense, then I am advised of this. And so that seems to be a good thing. And it seems to be a good thing to Gilbert and Dodds. And it makes me more autonomous. So I'm now more able to act in a way that's consistent with my values rather than being a slave to impulsive outbursts. But then you go a step further and you might think, well, what about technology that instead of, it doesn't just detect the neural activity associated with an impending outburst, but it stimulates. So it both reads from the brain and writes to the brain, and it stimulates the brain to avert it. And
taking the free will, is that?
It seems to be, yeah, it seems to raise questions in the issue of relating to free will or autonomy. And for reasons connected with that, Gilbert and Dodds were, they were quite, in our book, they're quite concerned about this prospect because it seems to close the moral window, remove a kind of autonomy, or maybe you can think about it in free will terms as well. And a thing that would be of concern to that, a sort of diminution of autonomy if it was mandated by the state. And then maybe the last one, I'll say the last one about criminal law. There's Walter Glannon. He's written in our book as well, and he's considered the possibility. This is maybe a little bit further down the track of what's known as a hippocampal prosthetic. So a hippocampal prosthetic would be a device that aids memories, perhaps by storing memories. And you know, obviously, the restoration of memory in people, say with Alzheimer's, or you know, that's another great thing. If that can be done, there's something great about that. But anyway, he envisaged the situation where perhaps you know, so there've been some sad cases where people have left a baby in a car on a hot day and they've forgotten that the baby was in the car and the baby's died. So in Australia, that might be gross negligence manslaughter, which is a crime. It's not murder. It's a step down from murder. But let's say the reason the person forgot was that the device had failed to store the memory in the first place. And so when they're brought before a court charged with gross negligence manslaughter, they say this device that I was using, this hippocampal prosthetic, failed, and that's why this sad event occurred of this omission. And so that would be an unusual, you know, that would be an unusual question for a court, because usually the idea is if you forgot, you're responsible. But yeah, so there's a lot of odd questions.
Yeah.
These are
I feel most questions that you propose that perhaps would be quite unusual for a court, right? And
yeah,
we know they would be quite unprepared in responding to such challenges. Have we seen any cases recently that are trying to tap into these challenges in criminal law?
Not of the kind that I just described. As far as I know, I'm not aware of any cases like that yet. There's newer technology is kind of used to some extent in some criminal matters, so it's not uncommon. No, I'm involved in a project called the Australian NeuroLaw Database, which is a joint venture between Sydney University and Macquarie University. And what we've tried to do is we've tried to find cases where people have used brain scans and that sort of thing usually in sentencing, maybe sometimes in connection with the defense and in other civil contexts. So the brain scanners, you know, so maybe what might happen is a person might be convicted of an offense and they get a brain scan, which is a kind of neurotechnology, and then an expert witness gives evidence of a brain impairment, and then the court's got to decide what to do in light of this evidence when they say sentence them. So that there's quite a lot of cases, and there's quite a lot of scholarly discussion of that issue. But the idea of somebody acting by way of brain computer interface or acting in an odd way as a result of some form of neurostimulation gone wrong or something like that, I'm not aware of any cases yet. So I guess the thing is, if some of these companies, like there's a lot of excitement about neurotechnology. I think it was the beginning of last year, The Economist ran a special feature on it, and there's you know, there's Neuralink, Facebook's bought Control Labs, there's Kernel, there's Emotive, Neurable. There's a whole load of companies that are trying to push this technology forward, some of them aimed at consumers and aiming for a sort of large market, maybe not just people that need it to address some kind of disability or medical condition. And if they're successful, presumably, then the law is going to have to start wrestling with the cases when people start acting because of or via these devices.
Yeah, and we can imagine how this technology in the wrong hands could be an absolute disaster, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, particularly in both reading and writing to the brain. So, you know, reading from the brain generates lots of brain data, and that data has got to be managed somehow because it's quite sort of sensitive data, very sensitive data. There's a Columbia University's got the Neuro Rights Initiative, and I've been working with Raphael Yust and some other researchers on a project with them. But they're very concerned about the use of how this brain data is going to be stored and regulated and who gets access to it, because it seems to open up the possibility of manipulation in the wrong hands. I think Yuval Noah Harari, he put it very well when he talked about maybe tech companies knowing you better than you know yourself. And, you know, that's a general issue with tech forms of social media and that kind of thing, but perhaps even more so when it's directly interacts with the brain. It seems to raise questions of privacy and autonomy again, and the possibility for manipulation. I mean, another issue is the possibility of hacking. You know, so for example, if somebody's making use of some sort of piece of neurotechnology, and it's not even clear that making use is the right word, because is it part of them? You know, like if a person is part neurotech or making use of it, if depending on your view of where they end and the technology starts, what if the device gets hacked and their perception of reality is now affected by the hacker, or the hacker engages in some kind, assuming it can write to the brain, it engages in some kind of stimulation that makes them more impulsive or something like that. So those are things to consider.
Yeah, so you touched on free will there, and I feel that perhaps that might be linked to privacy in a way. So, you know, if court needs to respond to how, when you made that decision to kill someone, say, and you have the technology, at, you know, at what moment did you decide that? And, you know, would that be considering the fact that we humans, you know, can change our minds? So you might think for a moment that you would like to kill someone. You might, you know, 2 minutes later decide that's probably not a good idea. So how would the law respond to that, right?
Yeah, there's an interesting question because, you know, on the one hand, let's assume it's a brain computer interface for control. Presumably the manufacturers of the device would want to make the person make it not too difficult to use, you know, so that if somebody has some intention, then the device gives effect to the intention. But then they don't want to give effect to sort of momentary thoughts that might pass through the mind and are not really thoughts that you want to act upon. And it's an interesting to, I mean, this is a challenge for technologists, isn't it? To find this kind of balance where...
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's not too hard. It's not like, are you sure you want to do this? Can you confirm again that you want to do this? Well, that's too much. But you don't want a sort of momentary thought to issue an action every time. And there's a question... I mean, I think this is an empirical question. You know, if people do start using neurotechnology and start acting via those technologies more often, you know, it'd be interesting to find out to what extent, what extent people are control, you know, if there's greater control problems in terms of controlling the devices, people controlling their urges and stuff. So that's an interesting one.
So in your opinion, is this a case, so if we're talking about Neuralink in specific, is this a case where the technology, the potential for good outweighs the potential for bad, in your opinion, or no?
People that are suffering from some very debilitating condition, there's just so many good reasons to try and address that. And, you know, I'd have to think more about this, but in my view, if the rest of us have to risk some kind of, take some new problems, if it does address, if the technology does address the issues of people who are severely disabled, then I think, we should wear it. But there may be some benefits to us as well, significant benefits to us. I think probably the upshot of it is not some kind of Luddite approach where technological development should stop. It's really there's got to be some kind of input from people who are engaged in normative questions about what people ought to do. So from ethicists and from lawyers, and that should probably form part of the development process, and also the regulators should be starting to think about it as well. That's my view. Slightly vague.
So in a way, law really needs to catch up, and potentially we need some type of regulations in place.
Yeah, I think the first step is starting to address the issues. I mean, even in relation to the criminal law, I've started to think about some areas in the criminal law. And, you know, as I'm teaching criminal law, I sometimes think about how neurotech might change things. But I don't feel like I've mapped out the whole of the criminal law. But there's all these other areas of law that they've got their own issues. And so the first step is for academics and for maybe law reform bodies to start just working out what some of the issues are. This kind of exploratory mapping thing that needs to be done of the ethical and legal landscape in light of this technology. And it doesn't seem, because it might come quite quickly, it doesn't seem like it's a good idea to just wait. To distill what I'm saying, I think it's a call for companies and maybe, you know, things like the Therapeutic Goods Administration or whatever, regulators should, start looking at this, the development of the technologies. The companies should be getting some ethical input, and law reform bodies should be starting to
think about that. Now you touch on some implications for employment law, and I think there we can also talk about what that means for the future of work. So do you want to give us a little overview of what that means?
I think so this is where I'm on sure footing in relation to criminal law, but I can gesture at these things. I mean, I think one thing that needs to be considered is, you know, so to what extent could employers require their employees to use neurotechnology? You know, so for example, an issue might be, say, somebody driving a heavy goods vehicle, and maybe there could be some neurotechnology that neurotechnology that might detect neural patterns associated with drowsiness. But then you might think, okay, well, that's kind of a good thing. We don't want drivers nodding off. It's not good for them. It's not good for anyone else. But then there's this question, how far is it okay to go in relation to reading brains or stimulating brains? I mean, like one possibility, you might think one possibility is an employer telling you to make use of some neurotech, maybe a non-invasive kind. And another is just, you think, right, I want to get on ahead at work and get ahead of my competitors at work. I want to get an advantage. And so there might be a sort of competitive race to upgrade. And so all this seems to me to be something that employment lawyers should be thinking about the role of neurotechnology in the workplace.
Yeah, I was just now remembering I heard one of your interviews, which was specifically talking about, you know, you talked about hacking before that, and in this interview you're talking about how DNA can be used in the same way, right? And could be potentially misused in court against people. And I feel perhaps some of the implications there are quite similar to this technology now that we're discussing and what Neuralink is doing.
Yeah, I think that, there's just, whether it's genetic data or brain data, that, you know, to the extent that those forms of data give information about people's health condition, how they're likely to behave, there's just very big questions about how that data is managed, you know, and how it's, who gets access to it. So the Neural Rights Initiative that I mentioned earlier, they're very interested in classifying types of brain data, because, you know, there might be some forms of brain data that are more sensitive than others, and others that perhaps don't warrant so much in the way of privacy concerns. But yeah, the whole question of privacy, and I think you're right, is related to autonomy and free will. So a nice observation, is something that is sort of underlined by these forms of technology.
Yeah, so perhaps we can start wrapping things up. It might be good to finalize this conversation. Thinking about, how do you personally foresee this collaboration between human machine unfolding in the next few years? And that's a question that I usually ask most guests towards the end. I feel it's you get different perspectives there.
Yeah, that's difficult, isn't it? It in terms of neurotechnology, I mean, I guess one big question is the question of how useful it becomes, and whether invasive technology starts. I mean, like Elon Musk is trying to get a sort of relatively easy form of invasive technology that is not of great sort of side effects, and a fairly simple procedure. Others are, as I say, are trying to go for non-invasive forms of technology. So I think, one question is which of these lines start to produce the most progress in terms of applications that people want to use. And so I'm somewhat hesitant to make a prediction, because it does seem to be a little bit of a sort of epistemic overstep. But I see my role as not really predicting, but just predicting. I see my role as trying to anticipate some possibilities, and then try to provide some ethical and legal reflection on those possibilities. And I think that's...
Yeah, sort of preparing. So you foresee some questions there that require preparation, right?
Yes, yeah. And I think that's an interesting thing for legal education. You know, like increasingly in my work, what I'm having to do is work with... work with people who are more knowledgeable about the technology than I am, try and work out what's possible and then reflect on the legal and ethical issues that relate to those possibilities. And that's not the traditional way of operating in a law school. You know, it's more reacting to things that have happened, you know, cases that have been decided. And maybe there's some reason for legal education to, you know, have a, as well as doing the more traditional thing of looking at things that have happened, moving to a more kind of anticipatory stance.
And taking a multidisciplinary approach.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that again, that's, you know, so I'm all in favor of that. I've worked with philosophers, I've worked with psychiatrists, I'm currently working with neuroscientists, and yeah, I think for these kind of issues, there needs to be some, because it, you know, like the danger is that lawyers and ethicists are too disconnected from the actual technology, and they don't understand it, and they don't really understand what's possible. And then on the other hand, the danger is that the engineers and the scientists have got a more rudimentary understanding of some of the ethical issues, and they need to kind of help each other, you know, because nobody, unfortunately, there might be somebody who's both a great neuroscientist and a great ethicist, but there's not many of them.
You know, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel that's probably the first step in thinking about the future. It's what we require. We need more collaboration there.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Allen, it's been really great to have you talking to us today. Thank you for taking the time.
And thanks very much for inviting me. Thank you.
Yeah. For people trying to reach out to you, what's the best way?
The best way is just to, if you Google my name, you'll get my website. So it's Allancay. And that will get my contact details.
Excellent. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.